and science and medicine. In so many areas, we don't do things the way we used to because we found better ways. So why should the recruitment process be different?
My name is Katharina, and I'm the Community and Event Manager at eCulture, a company that is on a mission to shape the world of unbiased hiring. Welcome to the Oops, I'm Biased podcast.
My guest today on the Oops, I'm Biased podcast is once again Léonie Grandpierre. She is eCulture's head of science, and she's been a recurring guest on this podcast for the bias series that we've had for quite a while now. Today, we're covering conservatism bias. Léonie will talk to me about what exactly conservatism bias is. She'll also give a very vivid example, look forward to that, where it comes from and what happens in our brains when, well, it creates conservatism bias, how conservatism bias comes into play in recruitment. And here we're going to definitely talk about the strategic level and also hiring decisions and how they are made. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about what people say who have made good experiences with traditional ways of recruiting and how that fits into the conservatism bias equation. Last but not least, we're always also going to talk about how to minimize conservatism bias. So stick until the end for some tips and advice that Léonie can share. Now, without further ado, I bring you Léonie Grandpierre on conservatism bias. Welcome to the podcast, Léonie. It's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me back again. I don't know why you keep putting up with me.
I mean, you're a favorite. That's no secret. Is this your fourth, your fifth time? How many have we done?
I think this is the fifth episode that...
Nah.
Well, not the two of us are recording, but the fifth on this podcast.
On the podcast. Yeah. Well, we're lucky to have you back. Thank you for taking the time.
Of course.
We are going to talk about conservatism bias today. This was one that, for me at least, wasn't really on my radar. And then it popped up somehow and I thought I should get Léonie to speak on this topic. We're going to have a bit more of a different format today for this topic, a bit more of a high over conversation instead of going into the nitty gritty. I think that fits it really well. Léonie should suggest it. So that's what we're doing. Conservatism bias can be a bit of an obstacle to strategic level in organizations. The drastic changes that we see in the world of work, notably economic downturn, talent shortage, skill gaps, AI as sort of a completely new technological advancement for the world of work in general, throws a bit of a spanner in the works for many. I can feel sort of a knot building in our listeners' throats thinking, oh no, what do we need to deal with next? We're going to discuss today what that has to do with conservatism bias and apply it a bit more to the recruitment context. And we'll get to the bottom of all of the things that we just introduced. So Léonie, I'm going to ask you, what is conservatism bias?
After throwing around a list of buzzwords to prepare people, let me start this off on a slightly lighter note. I'm gonna explain what conservatism bias is by starting with a story, actually. So this is the story of a Hungarian physician by the name of Semmelweis, or the German in me wants to say Semmelweis. I have no idea if this is how I'm supposed to pronounce it. Well, this man worked at two different hospitals in Vienna in the 1800s. And in both of these hospitals, women gave birth. But in one of the two, the mortality rate was about twice as high as in the other because of something that was known as childbed fever at the time. And, he was curious about why this was happening. Oh, why is there such a big difference between the two hospitals? And he figured out that in the hospital, which had the higher death rates, the doctors and the students that were assisting with birth also conducted autopsies on corpses in that same hospital, sometimes right before helping to deliver a baby. This was the 1800s, as I said, so not so much was known about germs at the time. But he had the insight to suggest that doctors should wash their hands with like a chlorinated lime solution before assisting with childbirth. And that intervention actually led to a decrease in mortality rate from 12% to 2%. So it actually helped save a lot of lives. So you might think, what a great discovery, fantastic life-saving scientific work here. The medical community, though, at that time, didn't really think that way. So as soon as he left the hospital, actually, they discontinued this intervention, and they rejected his idea that some of the childbed fever might have been caused by doctors not washing their hands after performing autopsies. This was way before germ theory, so really not much was known about how any of this works. But at the time, the medical community, they saw it as a sort of offense to think that a medical professional could be the cause of an infection, so that it could possibly be their fault. And the very sad end to the story is that the medical community at the time didn't accept the data that Semmelweis was able to provide that clearly showed positive effects of something as simple as washing hands. Also because they didn't think something that simple could be part of the solution to something that complex. And he actually, so the doctor, Semmelweis, he ended up being locked up in the mental asylum and died there for having, they locked him up for having such crazy ideas.
Oh, basically. Wow.
Like, you know, washing your hands after performing an autopsy. Crazy. Sorry for starting out with kind of a bummer, actually, this episode. I swear this is a point. I'm going somewhere with this. The conclusion is kids don't do science. It's dangerous. They will put you in a mental asylum. No.
So is that a science?
I'm kidding. Please do lots of science. Now, my actual point with the story is that it's actually a perfect example of conservatism bias, because conservatism bias describes our tendency to give too much credit to our existing beliefs and our reluctance to update our existing beliefs, even when there's clear evidence that something new works better. This is something that is sadly very visible in the history of scientific innovations. It happens over and over again that scientific discoveries that go against established norms in the fields take decades or sometimes even centuries to be accepted, even when there is compelling evidence for them. And in cases like the one in the story, this reluctance to innovation doesn't just cost a lot of time. It actually costs lives. So I would say it's a rather dangerous bias that we're discussing today.
Well, hopefully it won't cost any lives in the recruitment process or sort of in our field or our industry. But that's a very visual example. Sort of I can very much see it clearly in front of me. It probably does the most damage if we're talking about conservatism bias and sort of the effects of it in science, in the science community, because, well, if you can't really get through with new discoveries, then that might really hurt the developments and sort of finding new cures to what have you, any sort of disease. But I want to get to the bottom now of where does this bias actually come from? And maybe also tap into what happens in our brains to create this bias.
Yeah, so there is a theory that conservatism bias is actually a sort of extension of or a manifestation of anchoring bias. We had a whole episode dedicated to anchoring bias already, so here I am again shamelessly promoting my own content. But maybe as a short recap, anchoring bias is our tendency to rely very heavily on a first piece of information that we receive about something or someone, and that will then strongly influence our perception of anything that comes afterwards that we learn about this person or thing. And conservatism bias is then an extension of that, which becomes very visible when we're presented with information or evidence that goes against that first impression or that baseline judgment that we formed initially. So generally, it takes a lot less data or evidence to form an initial baseline impression of something that we then stick to than it does to change that baseline impression. So we basically need more convincing evidence for something that goes against our established beliefs than we did to initially establish that belief in the first place. I think if we go back to how biases are generated in the first place, this relates to how the brain likes to categorize things to be able to quickly look at associations between different concepts that it stores and that it then resorts to when there's not enough time and information available about something. And the human brain is quite good at creating categories and associations and attributing values to those, but it's not so good at changing them once they are there. So, that makes it a little inflexible. But there is research that suggests that some people are a bit better at this than others. So there's some research that showed that people who were better at a test called the cognitive reflection test were less affected by conservatism bias. They measured the level of conservatism bias in their participants by measuring how open these participants were to recalculating a baseline value that they were given for things based on new evidence that they were presented with. And then they compared it to the outcomes of this cognitive reflection test. And this is an interesting one. It gives people a couple of seemingly simple questions or puzzles that usually have a sort of easy answer that quickly comes to mind that is actually incorrect. So it's designed to measure a person's ability to suppress intuitive, incorrect responses and actually engage in reflective thinking. So those that were better from the participants, the ones that were better at showing this reflective thinking in the task, were also more open to recalculate baseline values when presented with new evidence, so showing lower levels of conservatism bias. So, it's a naturally ingrained bias, but there are individual differences to how affected people's judgments are based on this bias.
Wow. Well, that's a wonderful summary. I have a few questions that I want to follow up with. One, is it fair to say then that conservatism bias is anchoring bias and confirmation bias sort of lumped together and sort of amplified to the nth degree, or is that a bit too simple of an explanation?
So I think it's kind of a follow-up of anchoring bias. So I think it's something that naturally comes afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I think that confirmation bias can definitely strengthen it, because in confirmation bias, it's about us actively looking or ignoring pieces of information based on whether or not they fit with our beliefs. Mm-hmm. In conservatism bias, it's about specifically when you are presented with conflicting information to your prior beliefs. So it kind of depends on the situation. So it's more about what are you presented with versus also what are you specifically looking for and paying attention to, not necessarily when someone is presenting something to you.
Mm. I think that explains it very well. It wouldn't be a separate bias either. But mm-hmm. in some ways, all of the biases that we cover have some relationship to each other or trigger each other in different ways, or in situations come together in different ways. So I think that's a very nice way of putting yet another piece to the puzzle of all of mm-hmm. these biases. Please, Leonie already mentioned it, please go back to our anchoring bias episode and to episode number one, confirmation bias, to hear all about it. I think those will be really enlightening also in combination with this episode now. The last thing I wanted to ask is about that baseline that you mentioned. Is it an arbitrary thing? Do we all have different baselines for what we then fall back on with conservatism bias, or is it a shared thing? How do those form?
I think it's definitely something. Generally, your baseline depends on what you learn when you grow up. That usually forms your core belief system about things. So it's very much shaped by your environment when you grow up. So I think a lot of people in a lot of cultures have shared baseline beliefs based on shared environments when they're growing up. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that it has to be the same for every person. But I think for a lot of baseline beliefs are shared definitely by large groups of people.
Yeah, yeah. Because I was thinking about an example of, for example, I went to a primary school that was quite homogenous. Mm-hmm. Grew up in a small town in Austria, if that says anything. It was largely, primarily white kids, middle, sort of middle class backgrounds. And then I spoke to a friend who grew up in the United Emirates, and she grew up in Abu Dhabi. So she was in a primary school that was quite diverse. Kids from Indian, Pakistani backgrounds, Arab backgrounds, Europeans. And she, I think that her baseline for what a good representation or sort of a normal representation in inverted commas for society or sort of her age group was a lot more diverse than mine.
Mm-hmm.
So then for me, it was a big shift, positive shift, moving to the Netherlands, seeing a lot more diversity on the street than I did back home. For her, actually, it was the opposite. She noticed a lot less diversity on the street.
Interesting.
So
yeah.
She had a very different baseline to what she considered normal, mm-hmm. In terms of growing up. So that was my question sort of around, okay, is it sort of an arbitrary thing? What does it influence or what does it inform?
Yeah, I mean, going back to that, I think you can definitely have differences in what your baseline belief system is of what something should look like. As in the level of diversity around you, for example, or the level of diversity that exists in the world. So I think she might have had a shared baseline with other kids that grew up in that environment or other children that from an early age on went to international schools or moved around to different countries with their families. I think there can be shared views and shared baselines formed for a lot of different groups.
Yeah.
But, I think interestingly, because we're going to touch, of course, on the topic of recruitment, I think that the shared baseline of what recruitment looks like is one that is almost universal. But we're gonna get to that.
We're gonna get to that now. One last thing that I wanted to mention is especially diversity in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
I think me starting my career in the Netherlands has definitely informed my baseline of what I think is normal again, sort of my baseline for a work environment, what it should be in my view. So that'll definitely mm-hmm. going forward if I move somewhere else, definitely inform how open I am to different environments, I suppose. But let's move on to recruitment, as you already said. Why and how does conservatism bias then come into play in recruitment? I know there's quite some things that are to be said here.
There are many things that I can say about this. So I think that conservatism bias can affect a couple of specific moments in the recruitment process, but it primarily affects the general setup of how a company views recruitment in the first place. And I think there's a very similar baseline for the majority of people, as I just said before, on what things we believe are important factors to look at when hiring someone for a job. And I think that is because we were all taught similar things to create this baseline from the moment we start school. And I think that is quite similar, actually, in different cultures. We are taught that our education and which school we go to, which subjects we study, and whether or not we go to university and what kind of university degrees we get if we do, that those sort of things will determine what kind of job we will get later on. So we're then also taught that writing a good CV and motivation letter is an important skill to be able to get a good job. So this creates this really strong association in our brains between type of education and type of job in the future. So this is often the first thing we hear about, what's relevant for jobs. So that's our anchor, coming back to anchoring bias, and that creates the baseline. And sadly, that means our brains will stick to that at all costs and will actively look for information that confirms this belief and reject or ignore things that don't. So this is, again, what we call confirmation bias, where this ties in again, also covered in depth in another episode, as Kat has already said. And I think the big challenge for innovation in recruitment is that for so many people, the way to look at recruitment means CVs and motivation letters, looking at education and previous experience. This is people's baseline. So even when presenting all this available scientific evidence that is out there, that level of education and years of experience are actually very poor predictors of someone's actual performance at a job, our biased brains will do everything they can to stick to that baseline and to that established norm. So even when there isn't really any compelling evidence for this, it just came first and it was just encoded into our brains first and gets a sort of unfair advantage because of that. So now if we try to objectively look at recruitment, traditional recruitment, it's not working out very well in today's labor market. I think I'm coming back to some of the things you mentioned in the very beginning. On the one hand, there's a talent shortage. Recruiters are very often struggling to fill roles. And on the other hand, there's extremely high rates of hiring discrimination. People not being given a chance to ever even prove their suitability for a job based on not fitting a certain image that recruiters have in mind. And in my opinion, this is caused by the fact that traditional recruitment processes that are based primarily on a first impression of someone's CV, motivation letter, and an unstructured interview where hiring managers look for a sort of gut feeling click with someone. It's a process that facilitates and gives power to basically all biases that our brains have to offer instead of trying to fight them. And I think the resistance of many companies to look at the scientific evidence that is out there that provides evidence for the fact that this traditional approach is not actually the best way to predict how someone will perform at a job, that is a very clear example of conservatism bias, I think. A bit like the medical community in the 1800s that didn't want to believe that it could possibly be these distinguished gentlemen doctors who could be the reason for deadly infections. I think it's now the companies that cannot believe that it could possibly be the way that they set up their hiring process that causes mishires and a generally high level of hiring discrimination in the world.
Yeah, very well summed up. I have a few follow-ups to that. On the one hand, I want to point out that this might also be a really good reason why lots of the people at companies who are passionate about D&I, unbiased hiring, what have you, want to bring innovation into a sort of truncated, very traditional way of doing things, might have lots of trouble with convincing management, actually pushing change forward. That is also probably why a whole industry of change management consultants exist, because change is hard. Especially in times where, as you mentioned, finding well-suited candidates is really hard. And where historically a large portion of people have been just falling through just because they might have certain demographic aspects or traits that just on the one hand have nothing to do with it, but are being selected out because of that. So I want to reassure everyone listening as well that you're having a hard time because of conservatism bias. I don't know if that makes it any better, but it explains a little bit at least why lots of those early adopters of new innovative ways of doing things are struggling, I suppose.
You're not alone. It's a tradition that scientific innovation takes some time to be accepted.
It's the sad truth, but... To play devil's advocate on the other side, though, not all innovations are good innovations. I think we see this with the implementation of AI in sort of any field that you can think of. AI itself is based on large data models that in itself hold a lot of bias. So then the decision that come out of AI tools can be biased as well. So not all. Not everything that's shiny and new is actually good. So it in that way, it might bring a little bit of sort of consoling to the people who actually push back on innovation quite a lot, because there needs to be some sort of proven case, like validated by science, based in reality. So I think that is sort of the other side of the coin that might also be sort of an extension to, okay, why there might be extended struggles with conservatism bias, but why there might also be a little bit of that need for it. I'm not saying conservatism bias is needed, but that reluctance to changing everything at a at a moment's notice.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely, not all change is good change. Not everything that's new works. Obviously, you always need to check whether things have been tested properly and thoroughly, whether there is actually evidence. But I think with conservatism bias, it's specifically that reluctance when you're actually presented with compelling evidence against your beliefs and you're still reluctant to change them. And when there is that scientific evidence or whatever other evidence there is that is compelling enough to make a good case. So once that is there, which it isn't for every single innovation out there, but when it is there, then yeah, that there is quite a natural reluctance in us.
Yeah, that's a good distinction to make. I think that might also be where some people might find that loophole in saying, well, not all change is good change. So conservatism bias is very much welcome, which it isn't. But what about those people who are saying that they are making really good decisions in hiring based on their traditional data points, based on, you name it, interviews, CVs, cover letters? Wouldn't that be sort of evidence supporting that traditional methods might still be good?
I mean, I don't want to say that it's impossible to hire people who will perform well when using a traditional recruitment process. There's definitely the possibility that you will find someone good for your role. But I think based on the actual predictive validity of these traditional data points, like education, previous experience, for example, chance actually has a lot more to do with that than people are aware of. I mean, theoretically, you could find a good person when using a lottery to select your candidates. Not that traditional methods are the same as using a lottery, but some are maybe not that far off from that, I would say. Actually, thinking about it, a lottery might be more of an inclusive approach because it wouldn't actively exclude people based on factors that don't actually have anything to do with work performance. But putting that to the side, coming back to what we discussed before, the brain has this tendency to cling to its established baseline beliefs. So it tends to search for information that confirms those and ignore or reject information that doesn't. And I think that's also what happens a lot when evaluating hiring success. You will focus on the good hires you made through your process a lot more if you're convinced that it is a good process than on the bad ones. And another thing is that I think often hiring managers see someone doing well and then they conclude it was a good hire because of their process. But the reasons why this person is doing well might not even be the ones that they assessed in this process. So someone might be super collaborative, friendly, easy to work with, a critical thinker, I don't know. And that's why they're considered a good hire. But those may not have been the factors that contributed to your decision to hire them. So this doesn't actually prove that the hiring process contributed in any way to you finding this person. There's a big distinction to be made between how you feel about someone and whether that means your process is good. The bottom line is we as individual people are very subjective and often wrong. And I'm not saying every scientific study out there is perfect and completely bias-free and designed perfectly. But overall, the scientific approach is a lot more objective. So when there is a lot of scientific evidence for something and some individual's feelings speak against that, then I would still recommend to side with the science.
Understandably so. But thank you for that explanation. I think it's easy to, again, look for the information that you would like to see or sort of reverse engineer why you hired someone based on their good performance now, while that might not have anything to do with each other. Why you didn't select, well, why you selected them in the first place might be completely other reasons for why they're performing well now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Also want to quickly bring into this discussion, because you mentioned the lottery, education is still a huge privilege were not, and work experience as well. In a way, it really, whether you have received good education and have work experience at a certain age is really determined by how high you are up in the economic ladder. Not yeah. everyone can afford a certain degree of education. Not everyone can come with a track record of education to be then accepted into specific companies in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that's an important one to bring into this discussion when we talk about, well, might not be traditional data points good.
I mean, in the end, having a requirement for example, a master's degree might actually be a better, more accurate predictor of someone's privilege than it is of someone's actual suitability for the job.
Yeah, I mean, and that says it all. Yeah, no, I agree. And before anyone now clicks off this episode, I also want to say, obviously, there is jobs that require a certain degree of education.
Mm-hmm.
You can't become a doctor without having studied medicine. Can't become a lawyer without having some legal background. So there is a larger question then to be asked of how those educations are gated, how mm-hmm. much privilege lies in that. But as an extension of that, I think you can't really do away with all of that, but good to at least focus on evidence-based ways of assessing candidates instead of looking at the shiny data points.
I think the main problem there is rather companies using a degree requirement without it actually being about specific job knowledge. So I completely agree. Obviously, a doctor is going to need to have a medical degree and a lawyer needs to have a background in law. I fully understand and agree with that. My problem is with companies that use a degree requirement when it has nothing to do with the knowledge they need to bring to the job, especially when it is about someone's level of thinking,
yeah.
what some companies love to use as like a university level of thinking, which there's absolutely no proof for, that, you know, these skills that you're looking for, I don't know, critical thinking, deductive reasoning, whatever you want to define as university level thinking, there's absolutely no evidence that people who haven't gone to university don't possess those skills. But you are actively excluding them from the process by having this degree requirement if it's not absolutely necessary for the job knowledge.
Yeah. Well summed up.
back to conservatism
back
bias.
Back to conservatism bias. My last question before I let you go is, now that we've spoken at length at what conservatism bias is, how it influences the recruitment process, what can we do tomorrow to minimize the impact of it in our industry, in recruitment,
tomorrow,
on a day-to-day?
You work fast. I think something that we've discussed a lot in other episodes already are all sorts of tips on how to objectify your hiring process. I will not go into all of this again because I feel like we have covered this quite a lot. But that doesn't mean that my advice isn't still to generally try to find an objective way of assessing skills rather than making assumptions based on degrees and experience. But now this is specifically about how not to get tricked into sticking with traditional baseline beliefs, but being open to innovation. And I think for every company out there thinking about their hiring process, I would say try to reflect on what your baseline belief is of what hiring should be, and then try to find scientific evidence for this being the best approach. And I don't mean like finding people that tell you it works because of their personal experience, but actually try to find some science that shows this works well, and then compare this to the evidence that is out there for other approaches. And I think we are so set in our ways of what hiring should look like that we never even try to find evidence for this because it's just always been there. So we don't even question whether there is evidence for it working. But how do we know there isn't a better way? And I don't just mean the things we look for in our candidates. I mean the whole process. There's a new company, for example, that is turning around the hiring process and that lets companies pitch or apply to people who are open for a new job instead of it being the other way around. So it's rethinking the whole hiring process. And I'm not saying this is necessarily the best way. I need to see some research on this, obviously. But I want to say, be open to innovation and be critical of established norms. Because in science, in medicine, in so many areas, we don't do things the way we used to because we found better ways. So why should the recruitment process be different? So yeah, my advice for what you can do tomorrow is hire some critical thinkers for your HR roles to evaluate your recruitment process, and listen to science, please. That's my advice.
And with that, I want to thank you so much again for coming on the episode covering conservatism bias with me. Hopefully you'll come back. There's many more biases to be covered in the future. I hope you enjoyed this one. Thank you.
It turned into a bit of a rant, but I hope it was still informative.
I do think so. I think this was one that I think is quite ubiquitous, maybe not top of our awareness. So it was good to have that rant. Hear a little bit about what's wrong with it and how we can minimize it. To everyone who listened today, thank you so much for joining us again. Please come back in 2 weeks when we publish our next one. Let us know what you thought of this one, and maybe also let us know which bias that we haven't covered that you would like to hear about in the context of recruitment. And I will see you in the next one. Bye.
Bye.